Good afternoon. I call this meeting of the Human Services Policy Committee to order. Members, please take your seats. I note that we do have a quorum present. Before we begin our agenda today, I would like to remind the committee and people in the audience of a few housekeeping items. First of all, everyone in the audience must be seated when they are in the hearing room. Please no sitting or standing in the walkways or in the aisles. This will allow us to keep the accessible seating available for those who need it. Please leave all signs outside the hearing room. And all testifiers who have signed up in advance have been provided time to testify. I do reserve the right as the chair of the committee to impose a time limit on comments if we're running short on time. Time limits are provided so we can keep moving along and hear from as many people as possible. We will ask that room if there are any further testifiers who would like to speak when we have bills, but there may, that may not always be possible if we're running short on time. Thank you for your understanding and adherence to the rules. Our first item on the agenda is approval of the minutes from our Wednesday, February 28th meeting. Is there a motion to approve? Representative Curran.
So moved, Chair.
Representative Curran moves the approval of the minutes from February 28th, 2024. Any questions or amendments? Hearing none, all in favor of approving the minutes signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed, nay. Motion is adopted. Our first bill today is House File 3941, a Representative Curran bill. If Representative Curran would like to come down to the table, and if you could please move your bill.
Thank you, Chair.
I move to refer House File 3941 to the Human Services Finance Committee.
Very good. Thank you, Representative Curran. I understand that you also have an author's amendment. Would you like to please move and explain the A1 author's amendment?
I sure do. I move to approve the A1 author's amendment, and this amendment takes into consideration some feedback that we've had with some others while working on this bill. The primary amendment adds back in some language, just to clarify that there was some language that removed what looked like it removed a requirement for training on restraints and things like that. It did not remove the requirement. The attempt was to remove duplicative language, but just in order to avoid confusion, that language has been put back in. So that's sort of the meat of the amendment there.
Okay, thank you. Are there any questions for the Representative Curran? Hearing none, all in favor of the A1 author's amendment, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion is approved and House File 3941 is amended. Representative Curran, please explain your bill.
Thank you again, Chair. So House File 3941 is brought forward by ARM. This bill has modifications to Minnesota Statutes 245D, which we know is the regulatory statute that licenses service providers. These changes include both technical and cleanup changes, as well as changes that make some modifications that support workforce growth and development. To walk through the bill and share more details, I have Sarah Grafstrom with us today from ARM.
Very good. Thank you for the presentation, Representative Curran. And we will go to Sarah Grafstrom. Welcome back to the committee. Thank you for being here today. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and committee members. For the record, my name is Sarah Grafstrom. I'm the Senior Director of State and Federal Policy at ARM. ARM is a trade association of residential service providers providing services through the four disability waivers and supporting people in a variety of different living environments, from four-person CRSs or community residential settings to individuals in homes. The bill in front of you proposes changes to Minnesota Statute 245D, the regulatory statute for disability waiver service providers. This bill, as Representative Curran said, reflects both technical changes as well as proposals that would support workforce growth and development. I'll walk through the bill section by section and happy to stand for questions at the end. So beginning with sections 1 and 2, we are proposing technical changes to the language surrounding what is commonly called a 45-day meeting. Historically, this meeting, which involves service planning and goal setting, needed to happen within 45 calendar days of starting service. The timeline was a challenge for individuals accessing unit-based services or services that were provided more sporadically. The 45-day timeline felt rushed to begin goal setting. In 2021, we worked with the legislature to change the timeline, which now allows the meeting to happen within 45 days of service or 60 calendar days, whichever is shorter. However, in doing so, we left in various references in 245TE to what's called the 45-day meeting. So the language in Section 1 and 2 simply updates those references to reflect the new timeline that is already in place. Section 3 of the bill proposes changes to the qualifications for the designated coordinator position. The designated coordinator provides supervision, support, and evaluation of activities for individuals receiving services. They oversee the direct support team for certain programs and ensure the program is running in an effective and efficient manner and meets the needs of the person. The designated coordinator also works directly with the person's support team and case manager. Currently, there are four different ways, beginning on line 5.6 of the bill, that you can qualify to become a designated coordinator. The first three all require some form of diploma or degree in a field related to human services and corresponding experience. The fourth way is through years of work experience and corresponding training and education hours. Our proposal removes the requirement that the degree or diploma needed to qualify in the first three scenarios be in the field related to human services. This requirement drastically limits the pool of qualified staff, resulting in providers hiring someone because they meet the narrow criteria in statute rather than hiring the best person for the position. We are also proposing to remove a component of the fourth qualifier, changing the 4 years of full-time work experience providing direct services to a person with a disability to 4 years experience providing direct care services to a person with a disability, knowing that there are many parents or caregivers that have many more than 4 years experience providing direct care, just not in a full-time work capacity. Section 4 of the bill proposes a change to the qualification requirements for the designated manager. The designated manager is responsible for ensuring compliance with state rules and regulations, as well as looking over the company overall. The designated manager is looking at trends, patterns, compliance, and quality improvement, and making sure corrective action is taken for any identified violations. The designated manager must meet all the qualifications listed in Section 3 of the bill for the designated coordinator, and must also have a minimum of 3 years of supervisory level experience in a program providing direct support services to a person with a disability. Our language, beginning on line 6.16, proposes to remove the qualifier that the 3 years of supervisory experience be in a program providing direct support services, instead opening up the position to qualified staff who have gained their supervisory experience in a different profession, but again, still meet all the requirements that the designated coordinator must meet. Finally, Section 5 of the bill proposes a change to a current restriction in place for staff that are 16 and 17 years old. Lines 7.10 through 7.11 removes language that restricts these staff from administering medication. A little background on this. All providers are required to have a medication administration policy and procedure developed in consultation with a nurse or doctor and trained on and competency proven by all staff before they can administer medication. There is also the ability right now for providers to request a variance for the department to the rule restricting 16 and 17 year olds from passing medications. Looking at data provided by the Department of Human Services, since January of 2022, there have been 20 requests for this variance, allowing for 16 and 17 year olds to administer meds, and all have been granted. Given the success of the variance option, we propose to remove the restriction altogether. The changes made in Section 6 of the bill were reinstated through the author's amendment. So, Mr. Chair, that is a summary of the changes, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Okay, thank you very much, Ms. Grafton, for your testimony. Are there any other testifiers who would like to address the committee on House File 3941? Not seeing any. Members, any questions or comments? Representative Backer.
Thank you. My question, and it could be to the author or the testifier, you know, what other health care provider can administer medication that's under 18 years old? What other settings allow that to do that? Because we can't do it as EMTs or medics, so thank you. That would be my question. Is there any other ones that allow us to do that?
Ms. Grasser.
Mr. Chair and Representative Backer, so I am certainly not an expert on all of the different requirements and all the different services. I know there are some some legislators around the table that have experience working in the older adult community, and my brief research on other professions that allow this, that was one that kind of popped up as they hire younger employees. But again, I am not sure on what restrictions they have in place for their staff people. So,
Representative Backer.
Yeah, thank you. And that's where I'm have, and I appreciate your honesty there. That I personally, I understand that we have challenges with getting staff. I get it. I empathize. I mean, we all are seeing that. I have seen med carts. It is extremely important to get it out. And no disrespect to our 16, 17-year-olders out there. Though as we get older, we get life experience. And that life experience helps in that decision. You can have policies, I get it, but there's also life experience that plays an important role. So that would be my concern. I have had many years of training, but I, as an EMT, can only, we have to get variance to administer certain drugs. We're talking about a med cart with multiple drugs. I just think it's challenging even for someone over 18, over 20, over 30, over 40. So maybe you have an answer for me. That is my concern, because at the end of the day, I know all of us would agree around this table, we want to provide the best possible care. And it's no, I don't want to be disrespectful. It's just life experience when you're, heck, at 16, 17, my life experience is totally different than, I won't give my age now, but we'll just stay a whole lot more older. Okay? Thank you. If you could address that.
Representative Coran.
Yes, thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative Backer. And I expected that this might be a concern for some folks. I will say a couple of things about this. One is that we would never put any staff in any situation where they're not able to confidently administer medications that a person requires, whether that is, you know, someone's PRN medications over the counters, like giving someone ibuprofen or giving them access to their inhaler that they might be able to use themselves. Even if a staff goes through the training and the testing, there's a written and practical component to the testing that goes along with this, that somebody has to be observed doing this multiple times before they're able to do it independently. And there are, of course, as you mentioned, like, you know, as an EMT, there are even medications at that level where you have to get a variance to be able to administer. And that's essentially the same in the provider environment, where if there are certain pieces of medical equipment or specific types of medications, there is an additional level of training required that needs to be signed off by an RN in order for some of those devices or medications to be used. So we do have those mechanisms in place. And I would say too, you know, I can appreciate the experience piece. Certainly that's something that's up to each individual. Like you said, some folks maybe aren't familiar with much medication at the age of 50. I'm somebody who was able to measure my nebulizer liquids to the right ratio by the time I was 10 years old, and doing that multiple times a day. So it just depends on what your life experience is. I appreciate that. But I think the process that we have is a good one, and it's ensuring that folks, regardless of age, are able to understand and complete the process under observation first.
Okay, thank you. Okay, next on the list I have Representative Hicks, then Representative Knorr, and then Representative Backer.
Baker.
Thank you so much for this. I did just want to share the medication thing at 16. So I started working in a group home when I was 16, and I was not allowed to administer medication back in the 90s. I know it's hard to believe I'm that old, but I am. Then I went through the TMA class actually at 17, but couldn't take the test and actually pass meds until I was 18. And then for some reason at 19, they let me go work at Camp Winnebago and pass meds to dozens and dozens and dozens of people all day long as a job at a camp, which was way harder than the group home. because in the ARM setting, in the setting that ARM represents in these 245D facilities, we're talking about 2, 3, 4, 6, 7 people probably, and their medications don't change a lot. And luckily, for folks in long-term care, at least in the 245D setting, a lot of times they're even coming pre-packaged from long-term care pharmacies, where it lists the person name, all the medications they take, the time they take it, and it comes on these like really cool rolls. Anyway, and so then you check what's in the package against what's in the med book, and then you document it. It's a very, very well-organized machine at this point. So I did just sort of want to share that, because I think if you haven't worked in this space, you don't really understand sort of the process, especially around that long-term care medication administration, which really just does look a lot different than like hospital med administration, where maybe you don't see people, you know, you don't see them every day. And a lot of these meds don't change frequently. And when they do, there's a lot of staff training and support around those changes. So, I actually got a raise when I turned 18 at the group home because I could finally pass meds. So,
thank you, Representative Hicks. Next is Chair Noor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Coran, for bringing this bill. And I think we have progressed in how medication is dispensed. Nowadays, we do have automated systems. And I just wanted to inquire about how will that interact with the age that we just described. Is that something that can be put in terms of modification process to ensure that we have complete compliance and the regulations that are required?
Ms. Grafstrom?
Chair Fisher, we have a phone a friend in the audience, a provider that could maybe talk a little more about the nuts and bolts of it at the provider level, if I
certainly. Thank you for being here today. Please introduce yourself and respond to Chair Noor's question, please.
Yes. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Stacey Rowe. I am the board president at ARM, and I work for Provider Mainsail Services. And I appreciate your question. So we have progressed a long way in medication administration, and many people use automated dispensers. At this point, there isn't any connection. That's more based off personal preferences and conversations with their medical professionals. To what Ms. Hicks spoke to, almost all of the medications come prepackaged or in a dispenser. There's a lot of controls put in place around this. And I'd also just like to add, because when we first started talking about this, I have teenage girls, and I was like, ooh, how would I feel about this? And what I see is that by removing it from the rule, there's still that personal choice of, do I want to work in this field? Do I want a job with this responsibility? And people can choose to not do that if they're not comfortable and they don't feel adequately trained for it. But what we're finding is Spring Lake Park High School has this a program where people are trained when they're in high school to be EMTs and to be CNAs. And so by removing that age, you're allowing people who do have that lived experience and that desire and passion to start working a little bit earlier.
Okay. Chair Noor?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you. Representative Baker.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll be brief. You know, I signed my name on the bill, and I think what we're talking about is that hardest issue is that under 18, you know, and I get it. And I've talked to some of my folks back at home, the operators. Like Stacy said, the testifier, you know, we've got better training. It isn't like there's a bottle of pills sitting there, and we aren't going to give them one or two or three. They're all blister packed. They're all much more controlled. That's the one thing that we have to give credit to our healthcare industry is that they really monitor every single pill that goes through every single facility because of the risk of the liability. That's just not right. So, you know, it's good that we really dive into this. I'm glad that the department has been successful with giving some waivers and some exemptions. It's working. We have to listen to those kind of things because, folks, we have to start giving our work rules some more wiggle room. We just really do. And this is part of it. And we have to do our best job training. The operators know what's at risk. So I think that's where I have a lot of trust and, again, belief that this kind of changes in legislation is not overly scary for me, but because we just need to have young people like this know what it's like to really be taking care of people. This is explaining a little bit more. So again, I'm so far, so good. I like the bill. I'm glad I'm a part of it. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Baker. With that, seeing no further discussion, Representative Cran, would you like to offer closing comments and renew your motion?
Yes, thank you, Chair. Thank you, Committee, for the discussion and testifiers for the information. And special thanks, too, to Rep. Baker, where we met beforehand to discuss several bills, and I'm really glad that we were able to sign on to some together. I think this is a really great way to start making some meaningful changes in the field. With that, I renew my motion to re-refer House File 3941 as amended to the Human Services Finance Committee.
Representative Curran moves to re-refer House File 3941 as amended to the Human Services Finance Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed, say nay. Motion prevails and the bill is re-referred to the Human Services Finance Committee. Thank you for the presentation. Our next bill is House File 3743. This is a Representative Edelson bill. If you'd like to come to the testifier table, and if you'd like to move your bill, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move House File 3743 to be laid over for inclusion.
Okay, very good. Thank you for moving the bill. I understand that we'd like to have you explain the bill, and then I see you have some testifiers.
I do. Okay. I forgot my readers. This is going to be a little bit of an eye exercise here with my, for my 42-year-old eyes. Okay. All right. Mr. Chair and members, House Bill 3743 is a bill that was put together by the Mental Health Legislative Network. So they've all worked together on this. And I have the amazing Sue Abderholden here from NAMI who can answer pretty much any question regarding mental health in the state of Minnesota. So I'm just going to walk through parts of the bill that will be helpful for members. So section one is community support service programs are often viewed as drop-in centers that are crucial to breaking the isolation faced by many people with serious mental illness. The section here clarifies that clubhouses such as Vail Place automatically meet the criteria for a community support program. Section two is the first episode psychosis program that provides evidence-based intensive services and supports to people experiencing their first or early episodes of psychosis and to their families. Section three, there is only minimum research on early episode of bipolar disorder programs. We know that early intervention with intensity can prevent serious illness from becoming disabling. And that addresses that section. Section four addresses grants for voluntary engagement. Section five, it simply addresses occupational therapists to adult rehabilitative mental health services. Section six increases protected transport grants. Section seven allows contact with a client by electronic messaging, and that counts as an encounter. Section eight increases the county mobile crisis teams. Section 9 addresses mental health formula allocation, and I'm sure Ms. Abderhol can talk a little bit more about that. I think you guys, members, would like to probably know more. Section 8 is $2 million appropriation for engagement service pilot grants. Section 7 appropriates funding for early psychosis bipolar grants. Section 12 appropriates money for first episode psychosis programs. And section 13 increases funding for housing for supports for adults with serious mental illness. Section 14 appropriates funding to pay for the cost of configuring vehicle to become a protected transport vehicle. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'll go to my testifiers.
Okay, very good. Thank you for the presentation. First person I have for testifying is Ms. Sue Abderholden. If you'd like to introduce yourself, welcome to the committee. Thank you for being here today.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. Sue Abderholden, Executive Director of NAMI Minnesota. House File 3743 contains important policy and funding proposals. The media has widely covered the pressures in our mental health system with increased needs and decreased resources. Children and adults are waiting at all levels of our mental health system to access the right level of care at the right place at the right time, and the wait times are increasing. We have really struggled to get upstream to help people with serious symptoms with the intensity needed to prevent them from becoming disabling. We have first episode of psychosis programs that are incredibly effective, but we only have a handful, and they cannot meet the needs of the entire state. We have nothing of that intensity for young people experiencing their first episode of bipolar disorder. And for many people experiencing serious symptoms who are not, largely due to their mental illness, seeking care voluntarily, we do nothing. Nothing. Until they are a danger to themselves and others, and even then, we often don't help them. For no other healthcare condition do we wait to intervene until it is at a critical stage. The volunteer engagement part of this bill is critical to our preventing people with mental illnesses ending up in crisis. Can't we intervene before they need to go to the ER, before we call the police, before they attempt to take their own life? This option has actually been available since 2020, and no county is doing this. We need to try to see if this can work. I have written testimony from a mom who was frankly afraid to share her name and her whole story, but I really want you to read this to see how impossible it can be for a family member. For 15 months, she has fought to get her son care. He's had 3 hospitalizations, 1 ERDS facility, a couple of nights in jail, and cannot get the help that he needs. And through the volunteer engagement program, we'd be spending out a peer specialist who could visit that person every single day for 90 days to try to engage them in treatment voluntarily, to provide support to the family along the way. I think it could really be game-changing. Representative Edelson did go through the other sections of the bill, and there are items that could help the EMS problem by developing more protected transport. We can try to reduce the number of grants out of DHS by looking at a formula for some of the key programs, and we can ensure our crisis services aren't cut back next year. I can't underscore this enough. Our mental health system is in crisis, and we can't wait until next year or the year after that. The legislature really needs to take action this year. This bill contains many provisions that could help begin to address the crisis. And of all the bills that I've worked on and all the policy ideas for the last 22 years, I am putting all my faith in the volunteer engagement. Almost every single day I get a call from a family member who is trying to figure out what to do. Their son or their daughter won't seek treatment voluntarily. Partly it's because of their psychosis. They don't think that they're ill, and they are out there alone trying to figure out what to do. This could really help, and I really urge your support for it. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you, Ms. Abderholden, for your testimony. Next, I have Mr. Nicholas Rasmussen. If you'd like, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Thank you. My name is Nick Rasmussen, and I'm a resident of Savage, Minnesota, and I'm here to testify on my own experience. I have 2 bachelor's of science degrees, 1 in computer science and the other in business administration. I graduated then when I was 21, and I went on to work in a career in software development. I had a fine home in a fine neighborhood that was situated on 1.75 acres in what was at that time Credit River Township, just outside of Prior Lake. I provide that background so you may have some context. I experienced a psychotic break on or about June 26th of 2013. It was the ultimatum of separation or divorce that triggered the break, but the stressors that toppled me had accumulated through overwork and lack of sleep for a number of years. When I experienced my break with reality, the cause was a break in my body's ability to regulate dopamine. This physical breakage manifested itself in a variety of ways that were very obvious to those around me. I began yelling at coworkers, mistreating friends, and acting in ways that were just not myself towards my family. Within weeks, I was no longer working in my consulting position, and my life began a downward spiral, and it didn't have to be that way. What we have before you in this legislation is the opportunity to fund a pilot program for voluntary engagement. When I think of voluntary engagement, I think of someone coming to my home and engaging with me at a time when I had financial resources, private health insurance, a home, food, a support system, and still had within me the capacity to support myself if only my mental health was stabilized. Someone who could help me to understand why my life was falling apart and act as a partner in finding solutions and understanding the problem. I knew I was unwell, but I didn't understand the how, why, or what to do about it. As I mentioned earlier, the deterioration of my mental state was no secret to anyone around me. I can also say that I respond very well to treatment. If someone had shown up at my home the day after my psychotic break and formed a relationship with me, taken the time to work with me, to understand what the concerns were of those around me and how those concerns could be addressed, I believe my story would have turned out very different. I wouldn't have languished until my situation became a crisis. I wouldn't have lost my home and rental property to foreclosure. I wouldn't have had to see my online retail business collapse and a collapse of all the business relationships I had formed along with it. I wouldn't have had to experience civil commitment. I wouldn't have experienced so much contact with the police. I wouldn't have been arrested. I wouldn't have been jailed. I wouldn't have had to be placed on disability, and so many other things wouldn't have been necessary. I believe if someone had shown up at my home the day after the onset of my illness and assisted me, my illness would be a footnote in my life and not the focus of it. Please support the voluntary engagement pilot program included in the legislation now before you so we can make early interventions the rule, so our counties can be empowered with the ability to avert crisis and act on the concern of friends, family, and coworkers. Let's ensure everyone has the chance to receive the care they need in a timely and compassionate fashion. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Rasmussen. Appreciate you coming forward and sharing your experiences with us to help understand better what is happening out there, what we should be doing. Thank you for that. Are there any other testifiers that would like to address the committee? Hearing none, we will go to members' questions and comments. First person I have on the list is Representative Pinky.
Thank you, Chair Fisher. Thank you, Representative Edelson, and to the testifiers. I can't wait to vote for this bill. Can't wait to tell my family about this project. This has affected so many of our families, my own included, where we spent years trying to get help for a member of our family. And that opportunity ended with a domestic violence call that ended in more than one dead person, including my family member. There has to be ways. I've always found this to be one of the great black holes of our systems. And I've never known what a possible solution is. I do not believe in mandatory holds. I do not believe in taking people away. And this seems to be a solution that many of us have been waiting for. So thank you very much. I cannot wait to vote for this. I cannot wait to tell my family that we are starting to find ways to solve this problem. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Finke. Next, I have Representative Backer.
Yeah, thank you. This gets a little technical. I'm looking at line 2.29. Line 2.9, it cross out including access for individuals who live in rural areas. Obviously, I'm from West Central Minnesota, and want to know the reason for removing that, because as you know, Sue, that is, we need help also in Traverse County and Wilkin and Ottertail and Grant. So share me your thoughts behind that, please. And then I do have a follow-up question.
Ms. Abner-Holden.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Backer. So if you'll note that the way that it's worded in that section, it's like the existing programs are supposed to reach out to rural Minnesota, which didn't make sense to us. What we want is actually a program in rural Minnesota, not the existing programs trying to reach all over 87 counties. And so we added language on lines 216 to 217, where they have to fund eligible providers of FEP and assist with program establishment throughout the state, is what we wanted to do instead. So that, for example, maybe ALUMA could start a first episode program and serve the Northwest region of the state, instead of saying to the University of Minnesota program, try to reach people up in Crookston. So we're not eliminating it. We want it, but we want it done, frankly, in a different way.
Representative Backer.
Yeah, thank you. And that was my follow-up question, 2.15, 2.16, 2.17. I'm concerned that it might not be sufficient enough to provide the needed programs out there. That's my concern, those lines. And I haven't figured out how I would change it. So I hate when I say I don't like something and I don't have a good recommendation, because it's easy to poke someone in their eyes. I just know we have the same change. Maybe you can ask, would it ensure that grants would get out in greater Minnesota, in like mentioned Crookston or Browns Valley or, even Dumont, Minnesota, a very small community. So go ahead.
Ms. Abner-Holden.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Backer. So one of the issues with the first episode of psychosis program is you need enough of a population, right, to be able to have those specialists. So, you know, in the actual statute, we also say that money can be used for things like lodging. I've always dreamed of a Ronald McDonald House, right, for people with serious mental illnesses, because it's an outpatient program. So if it was in Kirkston, for example, we'd love for their money to be used for housing for people so that they could come, they could stay, they could really participate heavily in this program, and then go back to their homes. But it is hard with an FEP program because that you are using very specialized staff. You have to follow the evidence-based practice, and you need enough people to make the program work. So you need at least 20 to 30 people experiencing psychosis to make the program work. One of the things that the U of M is also looking at, if they started and they've tried to kind of start with some other grant funding, a first episode of bipolar disorder, is could you put those young people in that program together? Is there a way to use the evidence-based practices so you wouldn't have to have such a large geographical area when you get to very rural Minnesota?
Representative Backer.
Nope, that's it. Thank you.
Okay, very good. Chair Noor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Edelson, for the bill. Just a quick question. I think I wanted to know, how are we going to incorporate the cultural aspects of many folks who may need a different setting compared to what is already authorized under the new program here?
Ms. Abderholden.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Noor. So under voluntary engagement, so largely we're looking at most likely peer specialists who are really in a good place to engage with someone because they've been there, done that, right? And so there are efforts to actually include more people from culturally diverse backgrounds as peer specialists because I think they have an important role to play. A lot of homeless outreach workers, kind of the same thing. So, and I believe in the original language that's in the commitment law, we did talk about making sure that you are connecting people, you know, through their culture. I'm just looking at here. I think a big thing is engaging their existing support systems. A lot of families, right, have absolutely no idea what to do, so engaging them, I think, what will also be helpful. But I think a large part is really making sure that we have more culturally specific peer specialists, because they're going to play a huge role in this.
Okay, very good. Chair Noor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Will it be possible just to make sure that it's clear in the language under that section so that there's no ambiguity or interpretation who's included and how we provide those services?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Thank you. Then Representative Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As Sue Abderholden knows, we've worked on this a long time, a lot of conversations, a lot of challenges with trying to figure out how to address all of these issues and the concerns. And Mr. Rasmussen, I appreciate you coming and talking about your challenges, because no one knows better than somebody who's experienced it. So I thank you. Thank you for that conversation. So I understand we need to do these things. We talked about even the difference between where I live in Crookston, member, when Representative Baker does too. both of them live 4 hours south of me. So I think sometimes there is a misconception about how far apart we are, and then and they're still 2 hours north of me. Of Minnesota. So just ALUMA is great, but it can only reach so far. So I'm looking at all of this and I see money and the cost. And I'm not saying that it isn't important, but I'm wondering, Representative Edelson, how we can figure this out in a budget to make sure that these are things that we might be able to do in the future. You know, we can't obligate the next legislature to pay for these things, and yet I understand the importance of it. So is there some way to figure that out, or?
Representative Edelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Keel, that's a great question. So later on, I think actually, I don't know if it's a few days from now, we have a bill called Priority Admissions. So we're waiting for people to fail. We're waiting for them to interact with the criminal justice system, for them to get help. The bill before you is preventative. It's going upstream. People should not have to get involved with the criminal justice system before they're actually getting help. And even then, that's a flawed system. Even then, they're not getting help. So it's a cost to the committee, it's a cost to the state, but it's a cost to not do something as well. So
Thank you, Representative Edelson. And one of the things I'd like to also offer onto that is I know one of the things that has come out is we've had the rate study that's come out. And this is one of the things that we have to look at as part of the problem is that on many of our services, we're not paying the appropriate rate. So we're not able to get enough providers out there. We're not able to build out the system that we need to. And so this is one of the things, and it is a longer-term discussion. It's looking for where those funds are as we go forward. And I know there are a number of people in this room that are very committed trying to figure out how we're going to do that and piece together the system. Representative Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate that. And I understand exactly where we're at and how we're not able to help people, whether they're in the justice system or in the health area of needing help. I have personal experience. I won't go into it, but about how challenging it is when family needs help and you're sitting on the phone at midnight, 1 o'clock in the morning, trying to find someone to help what it is you need. And it doesn't matter who you are or where you're, how much money you have or how little money you have. There is, it is not easy to reach out and get there. Mm-hmm. And I know it takes money to get this set up. There just is no way around it. Mm-hmm. But I would really like to see that we're making it a priority because I think you are right. It's going to cost us a while before we can get people help so that they aren't in the justice system, that they are getting help. But I'm really concerned we might start something that we can't in the future continue. And as Ms. Abderholden knows, you know, since I've been here, I don't know how many years you and I have talked about what do we do. We've talked about how do we handle civil commitment? How do we handle helping people? And there seriously is a problem here. It is not something we should ignore, but we have to figure out how to fund things that will help people in the future. And all of those that are still waiting for help. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Keel. With that, Representative Edelson, any closing comments?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members, for the discussion. Representative Keel, I completely agree with you. You have been such a champion on complex, very complex mental health struggles within the state of Minnesota. And I think this is, we have to do pilots that where we think it, we're innovating, right? We have to lead. We have to try to go upstream. For years, we're always, I think what I've noticed at the legislature is we're always responding. We're always responding. This is a good way for us to use a tool to try to be preventative, to help people. I think the testifier said it best. Why are we waiting for people to get into trouble? Why aren't we, we're trying to be creative with this. So I just thank you, and I hope you'll sign on as a co-author.
Awesome. Thank you, Representative Edelson, for the closing comments. This bill is being laid over, and while there's a finance component on it, this bill, when it comes back out, will be part of the omnibus mental health bill that we'll be sending off to the Health Committee. So with that, thank you, Representative Edelson, and House File 3743 is laid over for possible inclusion. Next on the agenda is House File 4158, which is a Representative Hicks bill. If you'd like to come down, this bill is similar to a previous bill on medical assistance for employed persons with disabilities that was referred to Human Services Finance. Representative Hicks, if you'd like to please explain your bill.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, members. This one's really, really easy. It just takes the requirement for paperwork from once a year to, or from twice a year to once a year, and it gives a little bit more time for folks to get their paperwork in. Instead of it being 10 days, it's within 30 days. My favorite thing as an advocate was to get a panicked phone call from someone who had just received their renewal paperwork. And they got it in the mail on the 31st, and the letter was dated for 9 days before, and they were supposed to have everything in on the 1st, or they were going to be in a pickle. And so this just gives people a little bit more time to gather all of their information, and moves from twice a year to once a year for renewals to try to cut back on paperwork for people and for our public servants who have to process tons of paperwork. That's the bill.
Super. Very good, Representative Hicks. From my understand, we have a couple of testifiers for you, Bill.
Yes.
The first one that I have is Jillian Nelson. If you'd like to come forward, please. Thank you for coming, taking the time to be here today, Ms. Nelson. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Good afternoon, Chair Fisher and committee members. I'm Jillian Nelson, Community Resource and Policy Advocate for the Autism Society of Minnesota. You all are well aware that I'm a user of MAPD. This committee has shown phenomenal commitment to improving the experience of using MAPD. And today I'm here to talk to you about a policy-only fix that would ease the administrative burden of this program. Presently, users have to requalify for this benefit every 6 months. This renewal does not look at disability status and is similar to the process for standard MA, that this renewal is to confirm financial qualification continues to be present. MAPD has no income limit, and as of last session, no asset limit. So there's little point in doing this two times a year, and we are asking that it be adjusted to annually. This renewal requires an 11-page form, bank records, insurance documents, investment reporting, and pay stubs. On average, I turn in 60-plus pages of paper to show them that nothing is different than the 12 months prior. Additionally, they also receive my pay stubs monthly and full documentation of my private insurance that I am required to carry by the state. So essentially, I am required to provide duplicate documentation to prove that I financially qualify for a program that has no income or asset limitations. This is an absurd burden to place on people with disabilities, and to be quite honest, it's a waste of county time. We have extensive backlogs for more important tasks that are literally limiting people's accesses to care and supports. The other provision in this bill is extending the reporting period of change in income to allow people more time to gather documentation with a little more grace, as these changes often come with another major life change, such as a new job or a promotion. This is a simple change that would just make our lives easier. We appreciate your support for this bill and your support to continue improving this wonderful program. Thank you guys so much for your time today.
Thank you, Ms. Nelson, for your testimony. Next I have on the testifier list, Brittany Hernandez-Wilson. If you'd like to come forward, please. Thank you for taking the time to be here today. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Good afternoon, Chair Fisher and the committee. Thank you for allowing me to testify on House File 4158. As you stated, my name is Brittany Hernandez-Wilson. I live in St. Paul and work as the Equity and Justice Director for the ARC Minnesota. I am truly grateful for medical assistance for employed persons with disabilities. I'm proud to say that I've been on MAEPD for over 15 years, and that this program has allowed me to earn competitive wages for those 15 years. And in this time, I have come to know MAEPD and the process very well. As you know, part of staying enrolled in MAEPD requires that enrollees must apply every 6 months. This means reconfirming everything about me, including all of my assets, all of my bank accounts, retirement accounts, etc., even if nothing has changed. And it takes a lot of time to compile all of these documents. I also have to locate a printer because I don't have one and go to the post office to get this packet certified mail so that I have proof that I sent my paperwork in, a precaution that I take due to being on this program for so long. And it's a very tense time because my whole entire life and livelihood depends on this program. And if I don't turn in this information on time, then everything could be in jeopardy. Take my past renewal, for instance. End of December, I received notice that at the beginning of January, my renewal papers were due. I felt like it was too soon. I went back in my brain and I remembered I had filled it in this past August. I had just renewed. So I called my case manager and actually found out that that was a mistake, that my paperwork wasn't due until February. I was relieved about that because I happened to get COVID in January and was housebound for almost 2 weeks, which meant that I wouldn't make the deadline to turn in my paperwork in time. Once I was COVID-free, I went and printed out all of my paperwork and got it sent in before the correct due date. I was feeling good. I talked to my case manager again. She assured me everything was great. They had received my paperwork and my health care would not relapse. On February 1st, I received a letter confirming that my health care had been renewed, which is great. And, you know, nothing had changed because everything in my life had stayed the same. My premium was the exact same as the previous 6 months before. And things went well for about 2 weeks until I received another letter on February 16th notifying me that, in fact, my health care would not be renewed because they had not received my paperwork. At that time, I was returning back from vacation and only had about 24 hours to make things right or else my health care would be canceled. So I did what you're supposed to do. I called my county case manager to let them know I received this letter and that I was very confused. Because of the time constraints, I also called the Ramsey County Help Desk line, and the person that answered my call didn't seem very happy to be there. I let them know about the letters I had received and my confusion. They explained to me that the county had received my paperwork, but that it was not updated in one of the systems that it needed to be. I had asked some clarifying questions to make sure that I understood what was going on, and the person who answered replied with, "Did you just hear what I said?" in that tone. It was very frustrating as someone who has been in the system in some capacity since I was born, who has done these renewals every 6 months for the past 15 years, even when nothing changes, and to be received with such hostility was very upsetting. Thankfully, I am an advocate and I'm not going to stop at someone's bad attitude. But I think about what would have happened if English were not my preferred language, if I didn't know the language of the system, or that it was my right to ask clarifying questions. What would have happened then? Thankfully, a few days later, everything did get worked out, but the situation still sits fresh in my mind. I'm still waiting on the letter to reconfirm that I'm good to go for the next 6 months, and I'm honestly not gonna fully rest until this happens. And that's how it is for many people on the program. It's frustrating to have to work so hard just to receive these life-saving benefits, every 6 months turning in everything about me so that I can be reconfirmed as someone who can still be on these programs, especially when nothing changes. Because of MAEPD, I am thriving, working as an advocate in my community. Every day I get to live my passion, making a difference, and it's a big deal, truly. I know the power of this program and its ability to provide life-giving opportunities for people with disabilities who need waiver-level supports and are able to work. And that is why I urge you to support House File 4158, which would extend the review period from 6 months to 12 months, as long as there are no changes. It would also give us more time to fill out that paperwork as well. I truly believe that we can make this process smoother, more accessible to the Minnesotans that are on this program. We can help relieve the burden that our case managers go through to reprocess this paperwork, and we can put trust in the recipients of this program to apply yearly again, unless there are changes. Thank you so much for your time and for hearing my story today.
Thank you, Ms. Hernandez-Wilson, for taking the time to be here and sharing your experiences. It was very informational. Thank you. With that, are there any other testifiers who would like to address the committee? Not seeing any, we'll go to members. Members, any questions or comments? Representative Curran.
Thank you, Chair. And I just want to say thank you, Rep. Hicks, for this bill. And thank you to the testifiers for sharing their experiences with this. I know this is, like, it seems like a really small tweak to change something from 10 days to 30 days, but this is a very, very stressful situation for people to go through. And just an example of one small policy change that will go a long way. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Curran. With that, seeing no other comments, I will let folks know that there's a possibility that this may not have a cost. We're checking on it right now. If not, it may become part of our policy package. Otherwise, it is in Chair Noor's committee. With that, we will then move on to House File. Thank you, everyone, for testifying today. Thank you for the presentation of the bill. With that, we'll go to House File 4203, which is a Representative Pryor bill. If Representative Pryor could come down to the testifier table. I will move to re-refer House File 4203 to the Human Services Finance Committee. Chair Pryor, welcome to the committee, and please explain your bill.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, committee members, for hearing this bill today. And I will have testifiers that can go into more in depth. But basically, just so the committee understands, is what this bill does, it allows for one or more counties or lead agencies to engage in a partnership with the current Medicaid technology providers to allow expedited access to existing waiver benefits for 500 high-risk people currently enrolled in a Medicaid program. And let me just say, this committee, you probably understand what that means. I barely understand what that means. But I think what we know in general is there is this technology out there. And we learned a lot going through COVID and how things had to be done through telehealth and other innovative ways to provide access to health care. And because of that, we spurred on this growth in using technology and making it accessible for people wherever they are. So instead of having to travel miles and miles and miles in more rural areas to get to a doctor's appointment, this is a technology that facilitates that exchange between a doctor and a patient in their own home. And the other thing that this technology facilitates is the idea of, you know, just making sure you take your medication consistently, that you don't have to have a care provider that helps to remind you, like, nope, you haven't taken it. The technology helps. So it's this device that we can have in homes that facilitate better health care for folks. So this is something that's going on right now, but we can make it happen faster. And that's the idea, is that basically we're on the verge of new and better ways of providing health care to people with mental health, seniors, people with disabilities, better ways of doing it. Let's make the future come faster. And so this is just one little bill, one little idea, and people explain how this all works together to have our future come faster. So I'm going to turn it over to my testifiers and let them explain how this works.
Okay, very good. Thank you, Chair Pryor. First person I have is Steve Pontias. If you please introduce yourself, welcome to the committee, and begin your testimony.
Thank you so much, Chair and committee. It's my absolute pleasure to be here. My name is Steve Pontias, and I am the CEO of HealthyMed. I've been in healthcare for over 35 years and have been known as a disruptor. As the founder of MinuteClinic, I've learned that there are different ways to provide care if we think in terms of the patient or client. HealthyMed's founders share this vision. HealthyMed is a Minnetonka-based company that is committed to serving all waivered clients in Minnesota. For the first time, our clients can see primary care doctors to address their needs, personal medical choices, and have access to behavioral health services in days rather than weeks or months. In short, HealthyMed has taken a holistic approach to this complex underserved population by moving them from the highest cost setting of care, the ER, and moving them to the lowest cost setting of care, the home. We have been able to bring health equity to this population and lower their cost of care all at the same time. We install a TV in our clients' homes along with remote monitoring devices based on their acuity level. We follow that up with in-home nursing visits and provider visits through telehealth. Today, HealthyMed serves over 300 clients in 29 counties in the state of Minnesota and growing. We have lowered ER visits for this population by 50%. Raised medication adherence by 61% over the state average, and reduced missed appointments by 20% for this costly population. While this legislation is not specific to HealthyMed, it opens the door for assistive technology access in a much more efficient way. You may hear legislation is not needed for this. However, we believe that to be wrong. Today, this population in many cases waits 4 to 6 months to receive approval to receive access to technology that can deliver dramatic improvements to their health status and access to care. HealthyMed has been able to partner with a number of organizations that are on the front lines of serving this population, organizations like ACRA Home Care and the Global Health Alliance, who's here with us today, to use this platform to help their clients achieve health equity. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for taking the time to be here and for your testimony. Next, I have on the list Shannon Carlson. If you'd like to come forward up to the table here, welcome to the committee. Thank you for taking the time to be here. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Hi, my name is Shannon Carlson, or thank you. Welcome, Chairman. I am the clinical manager for Healthy Med. I have worked in community health for about 30 years and have been an RN, been a nurse for probably about 20 years, working with serious and persistent mental illness in their homes. It is my passion and mission to support and enable individuals to live as independent as possible in the comfort of their own homes and to feel empowered about the choices that they are making. Sorry, lost my breath here. That is exactly what drew me to Healthy Med, because that is their mission. I'd like to share a client story of one of my recent clients. They were referred to us by the county. That is how they are referred. Or they can actually be referred from many different sources, but this individual was referred by her case manager. I went out there, did the nurse consultant. She absolutely was in need of our services. I filled out a service authorization. She ended up getting approval, and our team went out there and got her started. She is living with COPD, anxiety, and depression, and hasn't left her home for 2 years. She left once to go to her daughter's wedding and another time to go to the emergency room because she was in need of care. She doesn't have a primary care provider. She doesn't have a behavioral health care provider because she had missed appointments, and essentially the trauma that comes with that, in her words, she was fired from her provider. We were able to get her in, get her set up with services. I can monitor her vital signs, her pulse, her medication adherence, and I can see her, how she's trending and like what she's doing. She called me one time. She was about ready to go to the emergency room. Her oxygen level was very low. She was very, very anxious. She just didn't want to go to the emergency room because of all the trauma that has happened from previous emergency room visits. I visited with her a little bit, encouraged her to take some deep breaths. We have an educational library in our platform, and we have deep breathing and videos on anxiety, depression, and I encouraged her to put on one of those deep breathing videos, talked with her on the phone, provided education on COPD and anxiety, and slowly her oxygen levels came back up. I called her about an hour later to check on her because she was going to take a nap and rest, and she was feeling better. So it prevented her from going to the emergency room. Last week I met with her again. We got her established with primary care. Because just knowing her, I didn't know how advanced her COPD was, and I didn't know if it was anxiety that was making her, you know, stay home, kind of what was going on. But the after meeting with one of our providers, the complexity of her COPD has her basically homebound. She provided her a bunch of education. She met with her behavioral health provider because she was not on any of her medications. She got started back on her medications. And just to hear her share her story is just so heartwarming. And I could share many more stories. But and I would ask her, I'm like, have you talked with your daughter? Have you talked with your family about what's going on? And she just shared that she feels like a burden, right? She feels like a burden to her family. She feels like a burden with the progression of her illness. So we are transforming how waivered clients access care, receive care, and engage in care at Healthy Med. We are making a greater impact when we partner with lead agencies to expedite needed and deserved Healthy Med services. Thank you so much for your time.
Welcome. Thank you so much for the testimony and for sharing your stories with us. Appreciate it. Next, I have on the agenda for testifying Ikran Abdul. If you'd like to come forward, please. Thank you for taking the time to be here today. Please introduce yourself, welcome to the committee, and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Dr. Ikran Abdullah, and I am one of the founders and the CEO for Global Health Alliance, which is a nonprofit organization that is locally and does global work as well. Our local work is started with maternal health and child, and we recently expanded to chronic conditions. And monitoring to provide quality access and service to culturally responsive manner. GHA is eager to partner with HealthyMed through Hennepin County Public Health Grant that tackles disparities and inequality in healthcare. This grant allows us, our organizations to bring healthcare services into homes of Hennepin County and beyond to population, for, especially for marginalized communities in the state of Minnesota. Where GHA Global Health Alliance comes in is that we bring on the ground engagement communication, community engagement to meet the community that we, to meet the community that, the need of the community that we serve in beyond Hennepin County. And to accomplish this with HealthyMed is to partnership and to do the specifically with the HealthyMed clinic at home service, where it uses the monitors and this program that we bring in into the homes of these clients that we serve, to be able to, whether it's a language barrier service that keeps them at home, that they don't want to go to clinic or cannot transport or finding their ways around, but be able to be at their home in their comfort environment and be able to utilize the healthcare services through these modalities that we're able to bring into partner together. So with the grant and the partnership will allow the clients that to serve culturally competent and virtually and access primary care behavioral health, especially to address their maternal health and allow for a proactive monitoring rather than being reactive. So being able to make sure that we are bringing the nurse that needs to be in the home, being able to evaluate them, being able to keep them from the emergency rooms, and be able to have that overall following with their chronic conditions so they don't deteriorate and not having anyone to collaborate with or to connect with. So what we're hoping to achieve with this bill is that to be able to look at beyond the Hennepin County and to be able to reach other counties in the state of Minnesota to be able to provide the same services to those that also well deserve to be served for this marginalized community. Thank you.
Welcome. Thank you for taking the time to be here, and thank you for sharing the experiences and how you folks do your work. Thank you very much. Is there anyone else who would like to testify today? Please come down. Matt Freeman, if you'd like to come down, please. Thank you for being here today. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Mr. Chair, members, Matt Freeman with the Association of Minnesota Counties as the Human Service Policy Analyst and also with the Minnesota Association of County Social Service Administrators. First, want to state that we haven't had a chance yet to meet with the author to talk through some of these concerns, but I am able to say that counties support improving access to technology services. Anecdotally, the feedback that I've received from counties in talking about this is that they're working hard to expedite technology supports, particularly because with the service provider shortage, too often that is the only support that is immediately available. Our counties would want to work hard to make sure that any expedited review and approval process allows enough time to ensure that there's an assessed need that these supports will address and that the person has informed choice. Counties work through processes, both internal and required, to ensure that these policies are followed. So we would have concerns if counties were required to enter into a demonstration project and would want to be a part of discussions about the key analytics and data that gets concerned, and look forward to working with the author, with the advocates, and DHS to ensure that if a piece of legislation moves forward, that it's workable for our counties and that we're able to identify appropriate placements for exploring this type of pilot. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Freeman, for being here. Thank you for raising the concerns and thoughts on it, and look forward to you working with the author. Are there any other testifiers who would like to address the committee? Hearing none, I'd like to thank everyone for their testimony. Next, members, any questions or comments? Representative Baker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Pryor, thanks for bringing the bill forward. I was able to go visit this company, HealthyMed. I was pretty blown away by the technology. Again, I'm so lucky that I currently have my folks in their mid-80s to upper 80s, and they're still here. But they don't leave home much, and that TV is a lifeline for them. And the part of it that got me excited, too, is it could be the family can kind of tap into it as well in the backside. That could really start talking about how are the meds, what are the trend lines doing. You can do a lot of things that you don't have to do and put mom and dad in the car and get them to go to some place for that. Again, this I was excited to say this should be in demonstrations in counties that want to do this, that show what's available, what it looks like. I'm kind of excited that this could actually grow into other things that could relate to more mental health and more substance use disorder. That could be almost like our just it has a lot of potential, a lot of growth opportunity, I think. So again, I'm happy to be a co-author on this. I think we should look at this kind of thing because, again, the reality is our workforce isn't going to be like it used to be. Our facilities are filling up. This is a new way of doing this, and I think it's really spot on. So I was really grateful to go through the company and the work that they're doing, and thanks for bringing this along. Thank you. I support this.
Thank you, Representative Baker. Next, I have Representative Edelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Pryor. I love this concept. I think it's like a good way to show that the public and the private partnership can really help innovate in our state. I guess what I'm wondering, because Mr. Freeman came up from the counties, I'm still trying to understand how, so it sounds like Hennepin County helped with, from one of the testifiers, with a grant. Is it all, like, doing this expansion? It seems interesting that we would go through DHS. I'm just trying to figure out how this actually all functions. It would seem like the county would be the person referring, but I guess I would love maybe the CEO. Maybe he could talk about how it actually works in practice and how they actually get people. That would be really helpful just to understand.
And appreciate that.
Chair Breyer.
We'll have the testifier comment and also know that we're, you know, it's good to get the reaction now and that we can make sure that there's something moving forward that does work to clarify some of the questions that we're getting right now.
Mr. Partias.
Thank you, Chair. Good to see you again. So the way it works today is referrals come from county case managers is where they come to us from. And the challenge has been the ability for county case managers to approve clients quick enough. Once we do our initial consultation with them and fill out the paperwork, we wait for weeks and in some cases longer than that for the county case managers to get back through the system to approve. In this time frame, clients can end up back at the ER. They can end up in trouble where we could help them if we were there. So the goal of the bill, at least from our perspective, is to find counties that are willing to say, we've got a population that we would like to bring forth for you to test with, to see how that works. This in no way eliminates case managers or approvals from that, or we're trying to streamline around counties or anything else. It's all about how do we get the platform to the people that need it quicker.
You're good. Representative Edelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Pontius. It's good to see you as well, Edina resident. That explains it. I was just trying to figure out the interaction because it seems like the county would be the most fluid way to have referrals. So, no, I love the concept, and I think I'm going to sign on as a co-author as well.
Awesome. Thank you, Representative Edelson. Next, Representative Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It sounds like a great concept. I will tell you, Representative Baker, that I spent 4 hours with my son trying to figure out the smart TV so my 80-plus-year-old parents could function with it. And they're in assisted living. But I think there are some challenges. I think it's a great idea. The more communication you can have, the better it is. But, oh, my gosh, some of this is really difficult. I would love to see your program closer because in rural Minnesota, people are going to want to live in their homes. That works for some, doesn't work for everyone. But having that eyesight on family is important, whether you're close. I'm 10 miles away, so I'm often trotting in to see what one of my parents needed. Even though there are nurses there, because my father, his first response is to call his daughter because she'll fix it for him. And or my brothers. I I'm gone, so they get calls. But more importantly, it's just my concern is that we are effective with it. But it sounds like a good idea. Mm-hmm. I wanted to warn somebody that, oh, my gosh, I wanted to pull my hair out 4 hours later. But my son fixed most of it, I think. So, mm-hmm. Thank you.
And if I can comment, Mr. Chair?
Sure, Chair Pryor.
Thank you. Precisely what you're describing is what this technology, the assistance that the technology is giving, is that when you see the demonstration, you realize it is set up where it's the remote that you're on the screen and you say, oh, that's the app that I want. And you don't have to call it an app. You can just recognize the picture and say that's the, and then you click on the picture and then, you know, it helps facilitate the communication that you need. So that's loaded already so that it doesn't depend on the new user to figure out how to set everything up. And so those things kind of, that's the beauty of having people do it for you, and so it doesn't fall on the family members to try to struggle with it.
Thank you, Chair Pryor. Representative Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just going to say video is great if you can see it. Mm-hmm. Macular degeneration really defeats that. So I probably need to see this, but mm-hmm. My mother is very hard of hearing and cannot see. So
your mother some of should that be is, my father.
Yeah. Anyway, it is really it's nice to see we have technology that works. I really do appreciate it. So
okay, very good. Thank you, Representative Keel. Not seeing any more comments or questions. Chair Pryor, any closing comments you'd like to offer?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And yes, Representative Keel, when I was getting the demonstration, I talked about my father, macular degeneration and hard of hearing, doesn't like his hearing aid. And he said, yep, you know, this is something that they'll keep working with. But let me, I think that also comes back to what's in the bill and what we have this potential to do, which is to collect data and to demonstrate, you know, how this works and how it can be approved. And we want to accelerate that process. And not just kind of go through, you know, the normal channels, which is kind of legislative time. You know, we get around to it once a year looking at it. We want to speed things up. And we want, right now, there are people that can be helped by this technology if it's in their home. People that are missing their medication, and this technology will help with those reminders. People that need these at-home televisits, and this technology will help it. So it's not a healthcare provider. You still have to get hooked into that system, but it brings that system to somebody's home. And so we know, especially if you've been there in my district where the company is and you've seen the demonstration, we know there's a lot of potential here. Not everything is worked out, especially how we're going to work with the counties and get that selection. But we're committed to the process and we'll be staying engaged. And we appreciate the hearing today, and we can appreciate being moved on to the Ed Finance, where we'll get a fiscal note.
Very good. Thank you, Chair Pryor. I renew my motion that House File 4203 be referred to the Human Services Finance Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay. The motion prevails and House File 4203 is referred to the Human Services Finance Committee. Thank you, Chair Pryor, for being here today. Our next hearing, folks, will be on Wednesday, March 6th. We'll be hearing bills from the Priority Admissions Task Force and numerous items on the peer recovery support services. Seeing there's no further business before this committee, we are adjourned. Thank you.